Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Lollipop, lollipop, oh, lollipop.
Sweet Tooth Steve Almond remembers with fond ecstasy the day he discovered he could buy candy by the pound. Almond turned to candy as a boy for a solace out of reach in his harried family, and he never turned back. When relationships soured or writing projects stalled, candy carried him through. He hoards chocolate treats so he is never left without, and he has trouble letting go of brands of yore like the domed chocolate and peanut butter Oompas and the Caravel, the chocolate bar that inspired his new book, Candy Freak. His conceit, notes the Wall Street Journal, is to treat drugstore candies with a high respect befitting Gourmet magazine. He's crisscrossed America visiting small-town candy factories and relishing the sweets that never make it to the shelves of Walmart, the quirky, delicious, outrageous regional candies, increasingly of yesteryear. Tonight on Point, Fear and Longing with the Candy Freak. In the year 2004, in the age of the Atkins diet, can you relate to an all-out obsession with candy? Do you remember the favorite, sacred, long-lost candy of your youth? What was it? And is it still around? Have you noticed the disappearance of the offbeat, one-of-a-kind candies from the candy shelves? Are you a candy freak? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Steve Almond. His new book is Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. He teaches creative writing at Boston College and is also author of My Life in Heavy Metal. Good evening and welcome, Steve Almond.
Good to be here.
Well, so you've been everywhere in the last month, talking a lot. Everybody's learning about your obsession with candy, and it is a mighty obsession, just a chocolate tidal wave in this book. Why is this just baked in the cake? Were you born this way? Was it really because your family didn't hug you enough? Why so crazy about candy, Steve?
Or they didn't feed me enough.
Feed you enough?
Or they didn't tell me to shut up enough. Well, I'm trying to figure out still how much is genotype and how much is phenotype. But I know that some of it is in the blood. And I know this because I have a nephew who's all of 3 years old and at 7 a.m. rises dutifully, trudges into my brother and sister-in-law's room and immediately makes a sort of fake coughing noise because
I need
cough drop, which is the closest he can hope to get to candy. So right. I think we can say there's some genetic basis for it. But as I've tried to piece it together for myself in the book, some of it is also a kind of self-medication. It's a dependable source of self-love and of pleasure. Relationships might fail you and friends and family and so forth, but a piece of chocolate hasn't failed me yet.
So if candy is self-medication, what does the great American medicine chest of candy look like these days? You're kind of bemoaning that it's lost a lot of its variety. What, where, why?
Well, the story of candy is the story of every single other industry in early 21st century America and late 20th century America. It's consolidated the few dominant buyout or crush the many quirky regional companies. And this is just consolidation. We could look at any industry, auto industry, the fast food industry, the soda industry, the media industry, and we'd see the same pattern. There used to be 6,000 candy companies in the United States during the boom years, which I take to be between the First and Second World War, and they were cranking out thousands and thousands and thousands of brands, each of them particular to a city or region. Mm-hmm. And Mars and Hershey's and Nestle, the big three, have really bought out or put out of business most of those regional companies. And so you still have great variety on the shelves, but it's variety created by just a few companies. And they do it very cleverly by introducing things like the Ballyhooed Kit Kat Dark, which is sort of the Hollywood sequel of the candy world. It's a what they call a brand extension. It's Kit Kat, mm-hmm. Kit Kat Dark, white chocolate Kit Kat.
Right.
They have a Kit Kat Orange and Mint.
But it's all Kit Kat.
It's all Kit Kat, and it's all introduced for a tantalizing period of time to get the consumer excited, and then it is ruthlessly and mercilessly taken away from us so that it doesn't actually cannibalize their main brand.
There's so much I want to know about that, and how kids who grow up in that world, the world now, are going to feel about candy, do feel about candy. But I've got to say, when we talked about this afternoon, just around the shop here, I mean, people rise to it immediately. You mentioned that old candy shelf. Mine was at Doc's Sweet Shop.
There you go.
And it was kind of a crazy quilt of stuff. I mean, there was nothing neat and orderly. It's a retailer's nightmare. A box is all different shapes. But people just immediately went off today. You know, gold nugget gum, wax lips people talking about. Or those little wax Coke bottles that you squeeze sugar water up, red hot dollars, those little hard dots on paper.
Yes.
I don't know what those were called.
Those are called old-fashioned candy dots, and they are made actually by Necco. So they're made right in Revere, and I've seen their production.
I don't know what's still here, what's gone, but give us a sense. You mentioned this more diverse world, 6,000 brands. Take us into, you've got a list in the book. You might just read it for us. I mean, it's so evocative, whether or not people know every one of these.
Sure.
The kind of, just let it roll, this kind of list of names of candies no longer with us, all
yes.
of these?
And these are all candy bars, even more specifically. And I will note, before giving you what I consider to be this sort of strange, incantatory poetry of these names, there have been 100,000 candy bar brands introduced in this country.
And come and mostly gone.
I mean, it's like species on Earth. You know, most of them have gone the way of the dodo.
But candy bar names. Yeah. Let's hear them.
Love Nest, Smile a While, Alabama Hot Cakes,
woo!
Old King Tut, Gold Brick, Prairie Schooner, Subway Sadie, Oh Mabel, Choice Bits, Long Distance, Big Alarm, That's Mine, Smooth Sailing, Red Top, It's Spiffy, Daylight, Moonlight, Top Star, Heavenly Hash. There's sort of an Empyrean theme there. Cherry Hits, Cheerleader, Hollywood Stars, Strawberry Shortcake, Ping, Tingle, Polar Bear, North Pole, Snow King, Mallow Puff, Bagosh, Dixie, Whiz, Snooze, Big Chief, Fire Chief, Wampum, Jolly Jack, Candy Dogs, Graham Lunch, Tween Meals, Hippo Bar, Old Hickory, Rough Rider, Bonanza.
Okay, we got it. The incantatory poetry of candy bars, Cheerleader candy bar. Now, what's that all about? And all of these, just out of the 100,000 names, what, if any of these, are still around? Or what isn't part of the Nestle, Hershey, Mars world? I mean, I remember old candy bars. There was one, I don't know, they get at the pool in the summertime, frozen, long ago and far away, called a polar bear.
Okay.
I didn't see it then for 20 years, and somehow, about, I don't know, 6 months ago, I was in some unusual place, and there it was. How do some of these candies still live at the fringes? What's going on?
Well, what's going on is that they are made, if they're surviving at all, they're made by small regional candy companies. And because it hasn't just retail and merchandising that has consolidated, it's also distribution. So it's much harder. You now have to have a nationwide network of transportation and also warehouses in which to store your products. So I hear, for instance, all the time from people about the Zero Bar, which is a white chocolate bar. The piece says peanuts and nougat and caramel, and it's considered to be by some party.
You know, actually, that's what I'm talking about. That's right. It's got a polar bear on it, but it's zero. You're right.
Bar.
I misnamed it.
Okay,
yeah.
And I hear from people frequently that they can't find it in a dependable way.
Yeah.
And it's not because it no longer exists. It's because the avenues to get it out there are very difficult. The same is true, for instance, of most of the bars that I ended up writing about in the book, the Idaho Spud, the Twin Bing of Sioux City, Iowa, the Cherry Mash out of St. Joe, a few hundred miles south of Vallomilk, out of Kansas City. These are bars that if you really hunted and searched, you could find. I would say really go on the web and try to find them. But you're not, if you go to your standard big chain store, you're not going to be able to find them.
We've got callers already calling in with their candy favorites. We want to hear from them. Everybody, listeners, are you candy freaks? What candy are you dying for that you just can't find? Jim is calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. How are y'all doing?
We're great, Jim. What are you salivating over, Jim?
Well, unfortunately, it's what I'm not salivating over, which is the Marathon Bar.
Yes.
You know, the best I've been able to come up with is getting online and finding the Curly Whirly. But
yes.
This candy bar is really hard to come by. Do you have any idea of what the story is now with this little guy and whether or not he's out there anywhere?
Jim, before we get the lowdown, the 411 on the Marathon Bar, give us your layman's description of it. I have never had one. Describe a Marathon Bar.
Well, the easiest way to describe it would be it's sort of a braided caramel with a very thin chocolate coating that tends to crack when you bend it, and it's usually about a foot or a foot and a half long. And I think I remember they had a ruler on the back of it, and the best way to eat them was to stick them in the freezer and eat them frozen. And often found at country clubs back in the 60s and 70s, it seemed.
Let's see what our Mr. Steve Allman has to say, our candy freak.
Well, actually, Jim, I too am a great lover of the Marathon bar, and it is the one bar, partly because of its quality, but also because of its packaging, that people remember a lot. So I want to just read you a little snippet that I have from it in the book. This is talking, I talk first about the Reggie bar that was that giant round peanut turtle, a round bar, or at the other extreme, the Marathon bar, which stormed the racks in 1974, enjoyed a meteoric rise, died young, and left a beautiful corpse. The Marathon, a rope of caramel covered in chocolate, not even a solid piece, that is, half air holes, an obvious ripoff to anyone who's mastered even the basic Piagetian stages, but we couldn't resist the gimmick. And then, as if we weren't bamboozled enough, there was the sleek red package, which included a ruler on the back and thereby affirmed the first rule of male adolescence. If you give a teenage boy a candy bar with the ruler on the back of the package, he will measure himself.
A foot and a half long, it sounds like a prairie schooner. What happened to it?
Well, it was discontinued. And Jim's right. The Curly Whirly, which is actually a British bar, is basically the same version of this. Now, I must say that the Marathon bar and the memories of said bar are fascinating because they prove once and for all in an empirical way that people tend to exaggerate the pleasures of their childhood bars. I'm going to break it to you gently, Jim. The Marathon bar was only about 7 inches long. But I always hear from people who say, I remember it was a foot long. I remember it was, a mile and a half long, and you had a... So.
Well, I mean, in reality, we all know the size doesn't really matter. So.
Right.
It was a great candy bar.
It's the motion of a caramel.
But tell us, before we lose Jim, where did it go?
Well, it was discontinued. As I say, it stormed the racks. It was tremendously popular. And my guess would be, without knowing in precise detail, that as with the Caravelle and other bars, it was seen to be in competition with an existing bar.
And so away it went.
And so discontinued.
Jim, I'm sorry for it, but keep it in your mind. We'll always remember it as your foot and a half job there. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thanks very much.
David's calling from Smithfield, Rhode Island. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
I'm calling not about a candy that was available in the U.S. and is no longer, but one that's available in Canada that I really wish we could get down here.
And that would be?
It's something called Coffee Crisp.
Oh, yes.
Actually, I found a number of them up there that I liked that we can't find here, and the only way I can get them is through the web.
Sounds like ordering your pharmaceuticals from Canada. You got to have your Coffee Crisp, David.
Right. If you're a candy freak, those are pharmaceuticals. That's your medication.
True.
The Coffee Crisp is an interesting piece. You should note that it's spelled with K's, obviously, and pleasingly.
Must be.
Of course. And there's actually an entire cult of people who are fans of Canadian bars. I speak now of the Violet Crumble, the Cherry Blossom. There's an entirely different candy culture up in Canada. And I know people, and this is probably a function of my lifestyle choices and taste in friends, who actually will travel north to buy candy from Canada because they love those bars.
David, thank you for calling. I speak now of the Violet Crumble. Sounds like Walt Whitman is waltzing into your candy room there. David, thanks a lot for calling in. We're going to hear about your candy safari tonight, Steve Allman. But just give us in a nutshell, what set you off on it? As I read, you had writer's block or something. You turned to candy and gave it to us.
I wouldn't say that it was writer's block so much as writing lots very badly. And for a very particular reason, because I wasn't obsessed with the topic. And this applies to fiction, poetry, nonfiction, any genre. I think good writing essentially is obsessive writing. We sense that the writer is passionately and maybe even dangerously engaged with the material. And this was not happening with a big, hairy, very turgid novel that I was writing.
Yeah.
And so I gave up on that, and I didn't quite know what to do. I started eating a lot of candy, started getting, a lot of the same feeling states I had when I was a kid. Everything's going wrong, and it's never going to work. And essentially, finally, started visiting the factories, And that's when it really took off. Because if you have not seen the beauty of a candy factory, you know, it's irresistible.
We'll hear about it. We're talking tonight about big candy, small candy, the candy economy, and one man's obsession with candy, above all chocolate. My guest is Steve Almond, author of Candy Freak. You can join us. Give us your candy obsession. What flips your trigger? Chocolate malt balls, licorice string, jelly beans, peppermint patties. Do you remember the favorite of your childhood? Is it still around? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about big candy, small candy, the candy economy, and one man's obsession with candy.
Inflation, trade deficit, horrible war atrocities. How are we supposed to do our big musical number with so many problems in the world?
Well, I know one thing in this world that's still pure and good.
Christian love?
No, candy. Sweet, sweet candy. What candy?
But don't you want to end world famine?
I want candy.
Or save the endangered Alaskan salmon?
I want candy.
Well, if you won't think of society's ills,
I want candy.
At least think of our dentist bills.
The Simpsons want candy, and you probably do too. Our guest tonight is Steve Almond, author of Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underground of America. Wall Street Journal calls him a candy idiot savant. Well, he calls himself a candy historian. You can join our conversation. Do you feel the tyranny of Hershey's, Mars, and Nestle at the checkout counter? Are you fine with Snickers, Reese's, Skittles, and M&M's? Or do you long for Caravels, Goo Goo Clusters, Blackjack Gum, Teaberry? What's your best candy memory? Can you stump the candy freak? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah. How are you tonight?
Great. Thanks.
I wanted to rhapsodize a little bit about the squirrel nut zipper.
Oh, do. The squirrel nut zipper. Tell.
Which is nothing I knew anything about until I moved in next door or across the street from the factory in Cambridge a few years ago. It's a wonderful, was a wonderful kind of ancient, you know, manufacturing process. But the odd thing about it was that nobody around New England eats the thing. Apparently, it was manufactured in Cambridge for years and years, and yet it was a big thing down south.
So make it in the north, ship it to the south. Was this carpet bagging, Steve Almond, or what was going on here?
Well, the squirrel nut zipper, that factory actually plays a role in the book. It's a very sad story. It's beautiful. In fact, all of Cambridge, Massachusetts, Main Street used to be called Confectioner's Row, and literally every single shop was a candy factory, candy concern.
Wow, and until very recently, Necco's still there.
Yeah, absolutely, and Necco, like most of these candy companies, these smaller candy companies, they're trying to sort of survive in the shadows of the big three. They moved, you know, to a cheaper location in the suburbs. But the squirrel nut zipper is a terrific piece. It's basically a taffy. It's kind of a fudgy caramel taffy shot through with nuts. And I think people did actually eat them around here as well. They were an acquired taste, but one sort of like Bonomo Turkish taffy that was somewhat obsessional in nature. The squirrel nut zipper, the nut zipper itself was the main piece. And there were also, you know, banana and mint and all kinds of other flavors. And the factory coming to an end, I interviewed the guy who was the general manager. And it was very sad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was great. It was a wonderful thing for the kids, too, because
they were cheap.
No, but I mean the process, not as much as the candy. Cause
you mean to go and watch them made, David?
Yeah, you could go in, you know, they would pump the corn syrup in.
Sure.
About once a month, and you get pumped up to the top, and it would come, you know, down through pipes and all sorts of, and the machines in there were ancient. I mean, they were 100-year-old machines that still made the thing.
Yeah, the general manager, when I spoke with him, talked about at the end of the factory's life, he didn't even have a desk, he was writing on his knees, and he walked around the factory for a moment and realized that all the music of the machines and people working
together. The gurgling and churning.
Well, it was like a symphony, and suddenly it was gone, and he felt this deep sense of freak loss.
Why Squirrel Nut Zipper? We've heard some wild names, but that may be the wildest yet. Might be right after Alabama Hotcakes. But do you know the source? Why?
I'm not sure. The etymology of the Squirrel Nut Zipper, I'm not clear, except that it was a taffy that had nuts in it, and of course the logo is this very dignified squirrel kind of up on its hind legs.
I see. Yes, the zipper.
Yes.
Yes. David, thanks very much for that memory, that call. Steve Allman, take us with you into some of these factories that you've visited. David, they're rhapsodizing about Squirrel Nut Zipper. You went out to see Valomilk and others. Give us the best candy factory tour that you can concoct on air.
Well, let's see. I definitely want to talk about the enrobing process of the Goo Goo Cluster. Now, the enrobing process. Yes, enrobing.
Superman in a phone booth.
In a chocolate cape. It's the process. It is the highlight, the high point of any chocolate making process. It's when the curtain of chocolate washes down onto the bars that it's going to cover.
Paint the picture. So the bars are presumably rolling along some conveyor belt or something.
They're chugging along a conveyor
belt. The Goo Goo Cluster in this case being pre-robe looks like or is...
Well, it's basically a disc of marshmallow and caramel. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a sort of like a flying saucer from the 50s. It is trundled over from the starch mogul, which is what it's made on. A starch mogul. It's this huge
piece of machinery.
Yep. Absolutely, that squirts liquid stuff into a cornstarch mold, which is aged overnight, so it hardens, okay?
Fine cheese,
yes,
but not.
Well, like a less fine cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And then those are sent whizzing overhead to a conveyor belt, and they're put on that conveyor belt. Chocolate is painted along the bottom of them, and a curtain of chocolate washes over this little innocent pod of caramel and chocolate. Peanuts are then applied to this bar by the device known as the nut applicator. I see you know. Mm-hmm. This down future
for
use.
For my future chocolate factory.
Exactly. And then miraculously, and this is the only double enrobed bar in the United States,
the Goo Goo?
You know, the Goo Goo Cluster, it is enrobed a second time. And it is the second enrobing that I found so irresistible because they really have to get a ton of chocolate onto the bar in order to cover all the peanuts and make sure all the crags are covered. So this little disc of candy bar actually almost disappears it becomes a sort of fist of chocolate, and then reverse vacuums blow off the excess chocolate so that the bar and all the inimitable crags of the peanuts emerge as in a time-lapse photograph. It's this gorgeous process where these lumps of chocolate suddenly turn each of them into, like snowflakes, into a different, distinct little bar.
Oh, Proust,
yeah.
Eat my Goo Goo bar. this is the square one? The one that comes on a piece of square chocolate, the Goo Goo?
The Goo Goo is actually round. It's essentially like a turtle.
This is on a piece of square. Okay.
Yeah, it's essentially like a big turtle, and they have different flavors.
So that's pretty good. Let me ask you on that front, then. Here's double enrobing. That's unusual. But if it were single, you'd bemoan the loss of the local candy factories. But is all enrobing not the same?
Well, yeah. All enrobing. The thing.
So
about
it's a matter of Hershey's makes it or standard candy.
I have to say though that the Goo Goo in production is like lots of these candy companies, totally chaotic. That is the nut applicator. The skins of the nuts are blowing around, and these everything's covered in tarp, and it looks like open heart surgery.
And this is a good thing.
Well, it gives it organic flavor. Well, it's not that. It's just that. I feel like it's a more realistic. It's not an automated thing. I know there are humans involved, and mistakes are sometimes made. Another good example would be the Idaho Spud. When I saw the Idaho Spud being made, which is a marshmallow, a certain kind of marshmallow, it's in the shape of a potato.
Yes,
it's made
of course.
In Boise,
yes.
Right?
Half a potato, I presume.
Yes, half a potato. It used to be a whole
long
potato.
Ways.
But
mm-hmm.
In the old days, it was two halves stuck together with milk chocolate, but those old days are gone.
Wow. Yeah.
Now it's a half potato shape, enrobed in chocolate and sprinkled with coconut. And when I was there, they had just gotten a new starch mogul, because that's what a lot of these companies that are surviving on, sort of
going high tech?
No, by having to buy used equipment, actually.
Oh, I see.
So
yeah.
It had
as the others
huge,
failed.
Yes, exactly. So it had a huge malfunction, and this liquid spud, which is sort of alarming, maybe sort of a grayish brown, was leaking all over the nozzles and onto the control panel and dripping onto the floor. And the response...
Liquid spud being chocolate or nougat or caramel, or the marshmallow.
It's the marshmallow.
Okay.
The innard is the spud.
Mm.
And what was fascinating was that You have to understand, in Mars and Hershey's Nestle, there are thousands of bars being produced, and the president is up in some executive suite looking over marketing studies and figuring out how to get his candy bars into China and Nairobi and things. This was at the Spud factory. You have Dave Wagers, the president of the Idaho Spud Company, covered head to toe in Spud goo with cornstarch all over him, and he is literally reaching into the innards of this machine trying to jerk the timing chain so that this, you know, Spud machine won't blow up on him. That kind of executive engagement you just don't find anymore. He's a candy maker.
A candy freak. We have millions of would-be Willy Wonkas banging on the doors here. I want to get them in. Jose is calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jose. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to know if you knew the name of a particular kind of candy that I grew up with in western Massachusetts going to the Eastern States Expedition. They had this candy made out of molasses. It was sponge-like. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, we've got molasses, sponge-like. It's mysterious so far. Keep going.
Yeah, it just was really, really sweet, and on the outer sides were very hard and thick. But then I remember it being served in a plastic bag, broken pieces of this candy, and the innards were sort of soft.
So it wasn't exactly a candy bar. It was scooped up.
It wasn't a candy bar. It was a candy. It was in different pieces. But I the only other place I ever found it was at Hilliard's in Easton.
Steve Almond is raising a forefinger with a...
Well, I know a product that... I know a piece that's similar to what you're describing, and you can still find it. That's why I was eager to tell you. The Whitman Sampler makes a bunch of delicious... Almost, if you're familiar with the Charleston Chew, how it's kind of a chewy nougat.
Mm-hmm.
They make a delicious molasses piece that you should check into. It's enrobed in dark chocolate. And molasses has become, it used to be a real staple of the confectionery industry,
right.
And it's become much less common.
Because
it's been replaced by corn syrup and by, you know, sugar and beet sugar.
Have people lost the taste for molasses?
Absolutely. It's a very distinct taste. It's to the modern palate, it feels like it's sour, or, you know, it has an aftertaste.
I miss it. I mean, I grew up feeding. Jose.
That's the part I love about it.
Yeah, me too. Me, absolutely. Jose, I hope you find that one, but crack open a Whitman sampler if you don't. You know, I grew up feeding hard blackstrap molasses to livestock in the winter for whatever was in there. Talk about sour, but gosh, that was good. Michael's calling from Provincetown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
Michael, you sound like you're in the bottom of a chocolate vat.
I'm here.
Step up, Willy Wonka.
I almost gave up.
Okay. Woo. Your starch mogul is killing us. What do you have to say?
Well, I just wondered if there's any correlation between the word candida and candy, because as we know, sugar is one of the big causes of that condition where, you know, you get, sick, basically, from too much candy or sugar and sugary things, and they tell you to stop eating candy, which that is what happened to me. So I'm just wondering if there's out there that tastes good and that is, you know, doesn't have that problem.
Well, you got sick. You go, in what direction, Michael?
Well, candida was with the diagnosis, and it was manifested, you know, through stomach problems and bowel.
I don't even know what candida is.
You've never heard of candida?
It sounds like an intestinal problem caused by a surfeit of. It's actually terrifying me to hear you talk about this.
Were you wolfing down circus peanuts? What brought you this, Michael?
I'm a sweet tooth as well, but I have immune conditions, so it's a problem that a lot of people get.
You need a really good sugar-free candy.
Yeah.
All right, Steve Almond, what can you prescribe, doctor?
Oh, gosh. Maybe some Zoloft. I mean, I wish I had a great suggestion, but one of my I feel terrible for you. My father, who's a chocolate lover, I inherited the freak from him, now gets migraines because of chocolate, and he has tried everything. And Carob, he's now sort of been reduced to trying to get my mother to describe the experience of eating a piece of chocolate so he can get a contact
while he sits
high.
Next to her.
Exactly. But my sort of ethos as a candy freak is that what your body is really wanting is a piece of candy, not a diet bar, not a sugar-free piece of candy. And my experience with the world of sugar-free candy has been nothing but bleak. I'm sorry to tell you that. I wish I had a great piece to recommend
to you. Michael, have you found any solace out there in the candy-free life?
No, I really haven't.
How about, I would suggest fruit and fructose. I mean, you know, if that isn't going to be give
no,
you the same problem.
No, that has some of the problems that, you know, but the thing is I was desiring something that, you know, looks and feels and tastes like.
It may be the snows of yesteryear. It may be memory that you'll have to consume.
Right. The problem is that chocolate itself, and this is quite depressing, but it's just true, is the most complicated flavor in the natural world. It has 1,500 distinct chemical components and all these amazing notes to it of honey and fishes and spoiled fish and roses and it's impossible to replicate. And so, you know, all these sugar-free candies and attempts to artificially replicate that flavor, they might be able to make McDonald's fries taste like whatever they want to, but they will never do that with chocolate. And also the body knows when you're getting real sugar. It has a physiological effect that's immediate.
Michael, we're sorry we don't have a better prescription. Try 2 spoiled fish and roses and call us again. Stella's calling from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Stella, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your sweet tooth, Stella?
Well, I'm calling about a memory from my childhood when our family took the circle tour around the northern shore of Lake Superior.
Oh, how great, yeah.
We did it the year that the road was completed except for the last little bit of gravel road.
Did you have to portage the station wagon over that?
Pardon?
No, just joking. And Candy made an appearance.
Candy made an appearance. We discovered Macintosh's toffee, which comes in a red plaid box and is so chewy that we would struggle and struggle and struggle to get it. Was scored into little squares, and we'd struggle to get the first line of squares off, which took a lot of doing. And then we would roll the box up in the window of the car and drive for about 50 or 100 miles to freeze it.
Oh, boy.
So that we could then crack it into pieces and consume it a little more comfortably.
That works around Lake Superior. Macintosh toffee. Steve Almond, is it in your repertoire?
It is not in my repertoire, although what I love about this is that it confirms what I have been insisting and people have been insisting back to me, which is that people don't just have candy that they eat, but particular oral strategies, methodologies for eating them.
Sure, the way you approach each different unique item.
The best example would be the M&M. You know, you have to make not just the decision of peanut versus plain, but do you bite or do you suck? If you suck, do you store on the tongue or between the cheek and gum? And do you, I grab an M&M between my two front teeth, crack off, you know, crack along the circumference, pop off one half of the candy shell, and then work the other half off
like
with
a pistachio nut.
Exactly. And then
there's a question of whether you take them crisp and cool from the package or hold them in your hand for 30 seconds.
I know people who have melted the entire package, have squished them all together, and then frozen them so they have, in essence, an M&M bar.
Stella, what's your favorite today, these years later?
Well, actually, now I can't eat sugar because it's a trigger for migraines for me.
Oh, boy. It's the trigger to hell here for too many people. Stella, we're sorry for that, but to keep that toffee in mind.
Yeah, but I did want to mention that it is slightly dangerous because my dad pulled out a permanent bridge on it.
Oh, gosh.
There you go. Every obsession has its price. Stella, thanks very much for calling. Steve Almond writes, I'm more or less out of my mind, but so are you, because every one of you has some form of the freak within you, has sought the succor of sweets in a moment of trauma. You can join our conversation tonight with Steve Almond, author of Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. We're talking about big candy, small candy, the candy economy. Give us your candy obsession. What's your best candy memory? Can you stump the candy freak? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, even with your mouth full. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The Candyman can.
The Candyman can.
The Candyman can, cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
Makes the world taste good.
Yes, the Candyman can, cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
Makes the world taste good.
Sugar.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking tonight about big candy, small candy, and one man's obsession with candy. Above all, chocolate. My guest is Steve Almond, author of the new book, Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. You can join us tonight. Have you noticed the disappearance of offbeat, one-of-a-kind candies from the candy shelf? What's your best candy memory, and can you stump the candy freak? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Charles is calling from Maple City, Michigan. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening, sir.
And I'm off the chocolate, but I'm...
Charles, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there's a little static, but keep it coming.
Right, I'm on a cell phone, and it's Schweitzer's Black Licorice. It used to be on the market many years ago. It was replaced by a cherry licorice, and I can no longer find black licorice anywhere.
The candy freak is nodding. What do we know?
Well, Schweitzer's is a brand that was discontinued. I can see the wrapper in my mind as well. It's still very possible to find black licorice, and I guess I want to say for anybody who's looking for a particular product, the last refuge of the obsessive about candy or otherwise is on the World Wide Web.
Of course.
All you have to do is enter the name Schweitzer's Black Licorice, and you will maybe not find a supplier, but you will find a support group of fellow devotees who you can commiserate with.
Schweitzer's there or not there?
I don't think Schweitzer's exists anymore, but there's plenty of good black licorice out there.
What's your favorite?
There's an Australian black licorice that I think is terrific. The Italians make a very, very pungent, actually use it as a breath mint, and it's in these little tins.
Yep.
It's sort of their version of the Altoids. And there are numerous brands. There's even a licorice out there that looks like little chunks of silver for some reason. It's also made over in Italy. So there's a ton of great licorice out there.
Right. We get some out of Canada that's a black licorice with a mint. But my mother was English. And we get a lot of, we try to find English licorice because it has a real strong taste to it.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. I would recommend one thing also if you're a licorice freak. There's a new product called JB's. They're made by Jelly Belly, the factory that makes gourmet jelly beans. And it's actually a flavored shell with a chocolate pod in the middle, and they make a terrific licorice piece. Licorice and chocolate you don't normally think of as mixing successfully, but it's wonderful.
Works. Charles, don't give up on licorice with a real kick to it. Thanks for calling. Joyce is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Joyce. You're on the air.
Oh, this is such a happy show.
Yes, about time, huh?
Happy show. Two things. I used to adore the cherries with stems in New York around Washington's birthday from Barton's Candy.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get that. But my real need is for liquor-filled chocolate. You can only get that in Canada and in Europe. And I don't know how to go about getting that.
What is the prohibition still on when it comes to liquor-filled chocolate?
My daughter has friends in Buffalo, and once in a while they'll go to the border and get it from Canada. But Lindt, L-I-N-D-T, makes it.
Sure.
And it's filled with Jack Daniels. It's filled with cognac. It's wonderful.
Well, the rest of the world eats it hand over fist. I hadn't thought of it. But thanks for reminding us, Joyce. Steve Almond, why is it not here in the United States?
Two reasons, actually. One, it's not kosher. And that's very important for candy production.
Do you mean if I go to the candy shelf, everything there is kosher?
Yeah,
typically,
most stuff would be. Well, obviously, stuff with gelatin would might not be, but much of it is because, of course, you want to maximize your audience.
Still, that would leave a lot of customers, even if it weren't kosher.
It's also very difficult to transport liquor across state lines. And candy, it complicates.
Oh, I see. You couldn't sell this to minors. Yes. Is that what you're saying?
Not just that, but there are laws governing what you have to pay and the legality of alcohol crossing state lines. So there are problems with distributing liquor-filled chocolates. Now, they can be found. Like anything else, it has its price, but it can be found.
But it sounds to me like at some level, a remnant of prohibition, at some level working there.
Listen, actually, Ashcroft, back in 1994, I believe, actually tried to shut down Bissinger's chocolates, a chocolate concern in St. Louis, because they made a liquor-filled chocolate, and the then I believe governor was concerned about children buying.
Didn't he cover the breasts of Lady Justice with chocolate in the? No, I must be wrong. Let's get one more call. Warren is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Warren, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I had a question about chocolate tasting differently when I'm older versus when I was younger. I remember it being really sweet and delicious, but now is my taste buds getting older, or is there a cheapening of chocolate around?
Oh, it's a great question, Warren. Thanks so much for calling it in. Steve Ullman.
Well, probably both, but definitely your taste buds become less acute, particularly if you smoke or you have a lot of coffee. The fact of the matter is, I mean, it's not like Olympic gymnastics where they only want tasters who are, you know, 17 years old, but your taste buds do naturally, the quality of them decreases over time.
So if you
time.
Think it tasted better when you were young, maybe it did, but
right.
What about the general quality of chocolate?
Well, the general quality of chocolate, it really depends on whether what you're talking about.
Well, talk about the drugstore counter.
Sure. Well, we eat Hershey's chocolate in this country. It's 22% cocoa mass. That's how they judge the quality of chocolate. And the really good gourmet stuff, because there's a whole cottage industry of gourmet pieces, are closer to 50, 60, 70, even 80%.
But has Hershey's always been 22%
yes,
cocoa
absolutely.
Mass? So there's no change in that.
There's been no change in that. And part of the reason that we like Hershey's chocolate, it's very simple. It's because Hershey was a clairvoyant of the tongue. He got his chocolate into our mouths. Mm-hmm. And that's how tastes form. They like Cadbury chocolate in Britain, which is the milk is heated to a higher temperature, so it has more caramely flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's how tastes develop.
The
they
baseline.
Are acquired. Yep, absolutely.
Steve Ullman, where do you go for your favorite candy solace these days?
Well, candy solace actually comes to me in frightening volume at this point. I have 50 pounds of coconut from the international.
But you're skinny as a rail, my friend.
Well, and I wear loose clothing, and I have I'm on the Fatkins diet at the moment, unfortunately. I have a good metabolism, and I also pace myself. Because if I wolf down a lot of chocolate, it's not just that I would get fat, that's one problem, but also I would ruin the pleasure of it. Part of the ethos of the book is that people should be incredibly grateful and conscious of these pieces of chocolate that they're eating. There's no way to stop consumption in this country. It's the engine. Consuming is the engine of America. We all know that. I just want people to be more mindful and grateful for these pieces because we have more good chocolate in the world right now than we ever have before.
Trivia as we go. I heard that the Clark Bar was on the brink of extinction and was revived by the Wesley Clark campaign ordering so many.
No, I don't think that's true. But Clark, which
Urban
is a Pittsburgh
myth.
Company, yep. Yep, and there's tons that are surrounding candy, I can tell you. But the truth is that Necco bought out the Pittsburgh Clark Company and has revived the brand pretty much.
Steve Ullman, this has been terrific fun. Thanks for your obsession. Thanks for your candy safari. Thanks for bringing the freak and laying it right on the table here. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Steve Ullman, author of Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. You can continue this conversation on our website, onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me for a look back at the week's news. This is On Point.
If you're not greedy, you will go far. You will live in happiness too. Like the Oompa Loompa Doopity-Doo.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We will hand over authority to a sovereign Iraqi government, help establish security, continue rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure, encourage more international support, and move toward a national election that will bring forward new leaders empowered by the Iraqi people.
They've gone it alone when they should have assembled a whole team. They have hoped for the best when they should have prepared for the worst. They've made America less safe than we should be in a dangerous world.
We all knew this was coming about as part of the normal rotation of commanders. General Sanchez has done a terrific job, and he's been there for over a year now. So it seems more to me in the normal scheme of things.
Donald Rumsfeld ought to resign immediately as the chief architect of this plan. Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, the intelligence chief Stephen Cambone, all ought to resign immediately. Our nation is at risk every single day. Rumsfeld remains as Secretary of Defense.
Credible intelligence from multiple sources indicates that Al-Qaeda plans to attempt an attack on the United States in the next few months.
He is suspected of providing material support to trainees in Osama bin Laden's terrorist camps, as well as dispatching associates from England to help establish a jihad training site here in the U.S.
The war on terror has evolved into a global street brawl, with governments and armed groups duking it out and innocent civilians suffering severely.
The flooding had left behind just a very wide, incredibly long path of destruction, taking away homes and leaving giant boulders, uprooted trees, collapsed vehicles, and the rubble of houses.
And there is a week President Bush lays out his vision for the handover of power to Iraqis in a speech at the Army War College. In a major policy address of his own, Democratic challenger John Kerry criticizes the Bush administration's policies. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez is replaced as the top commander in Iraq. The Bush administration says it has nothing to do with the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal that happened on his watch. Former Vice President Al Gore calls for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and others in a fiery speech at New York University. Attorney General John Ashcroft issues a dire warning of a possible terrorist attack this summer. British police arrest Abu Hamza al-Masri, a radical Islamic cleric wanted in the United States for allegedly trying to set up a terrorist training camp in Oregon. Amnesty International's annual human rights report rails against the Bush administration's war on terror, and flooding in Haiti and the Dominican Republic leaves over 2,000 dead and more than 15,000 homeless. Jack Beatty, it sounds like a week in which an impending election is beginning to sort and clarify. What do you think?
On the foreign policy front, yes. And I think William Safire had the best line that between these two candidates on Iraq and possibly even the war on terror, there is not a dime's worth of difference. There are some verbal differences. You know, Kerry makes more emphasis on we have to get new allies. But basically, he and Bush are for staying the course. And he's even saying he can do this better than Bush and tougher. Kerry has even signed on for something like preemptive war, if necessary. So there's been a merging of a blurring of differences, both on Bush's part, moving toward the notion of the UN, NATO, and so on, and on Kerry's, moving toward Bush on hardness and preemptive war, and even said, we will destroy you to the terrorists.
So at the same time, we have old Al Gore ripping there in New York. You're saying, no, not a clarifying here, but a merging of views, and yet, do you really think these candidates are going to go into the home stretch on this election, you know, in violent agreement?
I don't know. I just think that on this issue, that's always been implicit in Kerry's vote for the war. You know, I mean, it's very hard for him to say, well, you didn't do it the right way. Well, that's pretty much what he's saying. And so, yeah, I mean, in effect, this issue is going to be he's basically going to say Bush screwed it up. In fact, he said that, and rather than Bush shouldn't have done it.
Meanwhile, in Iraq itself, where it's all happening, events on the ground are shaping the way this war, this conflict is fought, American strategy even, it would seem.
Yes, retreat. Retreat at Najaf, retreat at Fallujah. You know, short term, this is good for Iraq. Fewer people are going to be killed. It's good for Bush. We're going to have an end to this kind of rampant fighting and casualties. It's good for the Sunni and Shia militia, which we pretty much dealt into the new state. But long term, look at the risks. We're setting up the constituents and legitimizing the constituents of a future civil war once the Americans are gone, with these militias clashing with each other. And also, we're devastating the morale of American troops. Once again, we've put them in a war they can't win.
Jack, you are hard to satisfy. I mean, do we really want to leave them in these mean streets, fighting Iraqis, you know, bullet fire tearing through civilians' doorways?
No, I don't.
Is that the answer?
No, I don't.
Couldn't this be an empowering? Maybe this is the way to bring militias into a political process. Give them some power.
Maybe so, but it's a risky strategy. It's a short-term strategy. It's a get-past November 4th strategy. Over the long term, what it looks like is warlordism as the model for Iraq. And no, I don't want our troops to be fighting unnecessarily. I don't want them to be there at all. But the fact is, this is going to hurt their morale.
Well, let's remember, I guess, in Afghanistan, it's warlordism. More or less, U.S. embraced, and President Bush holds that up as a model. Perhaps that is the future model here in Iraq.
That could well be, and that's frightening for the Iraqi people.
Well, the new realpolitik, perhaps we will watch. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.